Hello and welcome back to yet another episode of the VCpreneur podcast, a podcast that provides a unique perspective of the startup world through the lens of venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. I'm your host Digjay, and today I have with me Jyotsna Krishnan, managing partner at Elevar Equity. Elevar Equity is a VC firm that invests in transformative and scalable ventures focused on underserved customers and low-income communities. The fund has invested in 40-plus companies across India and Latin America, which includes impact-driving companies like Ujjivan, Samunati, Lead School, The Better India, Incred, Justo, Indify, amongst others. In this episode, Jyotsna talks about her path leading up to Elevar Equity, Elevar's unique investing DNA, taking concentrated bets while investing at very early stages of a company, why aspiration is the key emotion that founders should tap on when building for underserved markets, Elevar's North Star metric as a VC fund, building conviction as a founding investor, and how being a VC has influenced Jyotsna's personality over the years. I thoroughly enjoyed my chat with Jyotsna, and I hope you enjoy this conversation too. So, without much ado, let's jump in and find out what Jyotsna has to share. Hey Jyotsna, welcome to the VCpreneur podcast. Glad to have you with us today. Thank you so much for taking out the time.
Thanks, Digjay. Pleasure.
Okay, awesome. So for folks who, you know, don't know you yet, maybe we can start with a brief background about yourself. You know, tell us about your path leading up to Elevar.
Interesting. So I'm a Delhi girl, born, brought up in Delhi, graduated from North Campus, Shriram College of Commerce. And there are early life incidents that probably relate deeply to my journey at Elevar. So maybe I touch upon that. You know, with most college students, it's the time when you're discovering yourself. And as part of those growing up years, I ended up traveling into smaller towns and cities, primarily with my mom, who was working with grassroots self-help groups, etc., on the ground. And I realized there was a phenomenal sense of admiration I had for households, women, members of low-income communities. And when I say low-income communities, it's all of those people who definitely have much lesser at disposal, but seem to have a phenomenal enterprising spirit, a sense of resilience, and a certain maturity with which they led lives. Now, if you think about a typical Delhi student in college looking at a very different quality of conversation, it was definitely something that made a difference and made an impact in my mind, which followed through. I did my MBA from SPJ and I moved to Bombay. And you know how you typically write those SOPs and 5-year forward statements. I always said that, you know, I work for 5-6 years in the corporate space and then do something that's more meaningful after that. I ended up joining HSBC as a management trainee. Well, the 5-6 years probably ended up closer to 8 years. Spent that time in a range of roles. Started my career managing wealth for high net worth individuals. At some point, I was leading their wealth, learning and development vertical, working with a lot of team members across India and 6 other NRI locations. And eventually, I was working as part of the team that was looking at retail distribution strategy and finance. In all of this, I realized at multiple points that where I felt the highest levels of energy and inspiration was when I was spending time with someone who had fewer resources. So in a bizarre way, it wasn't a sense that I need to go help them, but I would almost term it as self-interest. I think I felt a lot more excited and inspired when I was spending time with them, and I just felt a connect. So something as simple as that led me to this exploration sometime in 2011, where I said, if I really want to think about what I want to do with my career. And I guess the important milestone then was I was turning 30, and I thought maybe I should think about life a little differently. And as I did some soul searching, I was like, I want to do something that excites me at a level where work doesn't feel like work. I ended up getting connected with Sandeep and Elevar through some common friends, and I realized it just felt right. And so I moved from Bombay to Bangalore. It was, I guess, my entrepreneurial calling that brought me to Bangalore. Elevar was still in its early days back then. We were investing in themes beyond microfinance. But what I distinctly remember at that point was a lot of advice, because at that time, when you've spent your life in retail financial services and you're talking about a certain mass market customer segment, when you marry the two, you get microfinance. And microfinance was in deep crisis back then. And almost every second person I met said, it's a bad idea to even look in that direction right now. The only thing that I couldn't shake off is that that market is so large and so exciting. And I was like, I couldn't believe that blip could make permanent damage or difference to what it was. So I decided to take the plunge irrespective and move to Hyderabad back then. So that's how I entered the space, I guess.
Awesome. I think that's very good background. And yeah, I mean, you're right. After a point in your career, you start thinking about, you know, what feels more like play rather than work. And a lot of self-awareness comes through, and that helps, you know, in making that decision. And to your point, to, you know, moving to Bangalore and starting this as a part of an early team at Elevar. Yeah, I mean, starting a fund and starting your journey as a venture capitalist is not less than an entrepreneurial journey. I would say relatively slightly easier than, you know, what a founder embarks on. But still, nonetheless, you know, it takes a lot of effort and a lot of sweat and a lot of conviction to go down that route as well. So kudos to you. And I've read a lot about Elevar, but, you know, for our audience, if you could expand upon, you know, what's unique or what's novel about Elevar when it comes to impact investing, how are you different from, you know, some of the other impact investing funds as well that are playing in the same sector?
It's a good question. And I guess it'll be a little presumptuous to try and call out what's unique, etc. But I will say each organization is known for its DNA. And that DNA is a very recurrent theme, whether we think about ourselves or our portfolio companies, our entrepreneurs, the organizations they're building, etc. And from that DNA standpoint, maybe I can talk a bit about Elevar's DNA. Our genesis lies in very, very closely understanding the pulse of our end market, right? It started early back in 2004, 2006 timeframes in dealing with microfinance as an early business model. The genesis of Elevar goes back to times when microfinance operated as a nonprofit model in India. And a lot of work was done to help companies transition into for-profit as well as make some of the early equity investments in what are now large organizations and small finance banks, et cetera. But that DNA is important because the pulse of that end customer had nothing to do with a sector or a product or a business model. It is literally like having expertise in knowing what a certain market is willing to spend on and is prioritizing spends on, and a lot of nuance around that. And that has been super useful in defining Elevar's future strategies. When the second fund was raised, it was very clear that we would go beyond microfinance all the way back in 2008, 2009. And it was very clear that this customer segment was aspirational. They had the purchasing power. They were willing to evolve. And there's a certain nuance to every bit of that statement that I just made, which evolves into an investing strategy. And so we've seen that evolve over time from the first fund to the second fund that started looking at other adjacencies in financial services, healthcare, payments, etc., as well as moving beyond into spaces like education, agri, MSME services, both linked to financial services as well as outside of financial services. And we did that across India and Latin America, which has been super exciting because on the face of it, everyone's always puzzled as to why these two markets. But again, if you go back to the DNA of the organization, if you take a customer view and a customer lens, these two markets are extremely similar. The dynamics you see on the ground, the evolution of this customer segment is quite comparable. And therefore, we found a lot of synergies. It helps that the partnership understands these two markets really closely. And that's the DNA as a firm. I would also add that we're a strange cross between VC and PE in some sense, right? VC, venture capital and private equity. Venture capital is typically associated with very early bets that have a high risk of failure potentially and some outsized returns. Private equity is about taking far more calibrated calls. I will say for a fund like ours that goes in very early, most of our investments, we call them as, I mean, we're kind of founding investors in the sense we're there alongside the founding of the company and the founders, almost backing paper plans. But these are not investments that are very small pre-seed, seed kind of investments. They're meaningful checks leading to a very, very concentrated portfolio. So if you look at a portfolio, it would resemble private equity a lot more. But if you look at the stage at which we go in, we're very happy going in the stage at which venture capital goes in. So that's another uniqueness to the DNA that we've always maintained. And therefore, we probably are a rare venture or an early stage investor that does maybe 3-4 investments on an average as against a lot more. And finally, I would say we are super strong believers in aligning all the way from the end consumer all up to mainstream capital. We do believe the space we operate in has a lot of appetite for growth. We also believe there isn't enough in courts impact money or, you know, purposeful money, et cetera, that can actually do justice to the appetite for growth that this customer segment has. And therefore, it's important to look for opportunities and build opportunities that can align what this end customer is looking for and what a mainstream regular private equity, public markets investor would look for in terms of return profile, right? So like I was talking about my own personal background, I'm a big believer that I think there is self-interest is not to be dismissed or admonished. It's important that everyone looks out for interest. So if there's capital, it needs to make its returns. If there's talent, it needs to be rewarded. If there are entrepreneurs, they should create wealth. And if there are customers, they should benefit for what they pay for, right? And if you manage a way that aligns everything, you have a beautiful, scalable journey that achieves multiple purposes.
Just love the clarity, you know, of how you've laid out that DNA. And you know, there's so much to unpack from all that you described that your DNA makes up. But let me start with, you know, what you mentioned earlier, the bottom-up approach of investing. You spend a significant time, you know, understanding the customer segments and being close to the customer, getting a pulse of, you know, how they want to make decisions with respect to how do you want they want to spend money. And also links to the founder side, which is the new trend that we are seeing, right? The products are now being built for this mass market. It's no more a play of, you know, borrowing foreign ideas and building X for India or Y for India. And we're seeing that trend shaping up. Mm-hmm. Like you, I'm bullish on, you know, the growth of that market and the kind of business models that are going to come out of that trend overall. What are you hearing from these customers today? You know, post the geo-led internet boom and also the proliferation of banking, you know, access to bank accounts that has happened in the last 5 years. What are the new business models that you see thriving in the coming decade based on, you know, this platform that is set?
Loaded question. But let's see. Firstly, who's this customer segment that we're talking about, right? We're talking about people for whom, let's say, mainstream corporate India is not yet designed their organizations, their distributions, their DNAs for. In the olden days, what microfinance did vis-a-vis banks is the equivalent of what a lot of business models today are doing vis-a-vis traditional healthcare, traditional education, etc. And in that context, if we double click on this customer segment, we're talking about people who definitely have the purchasing power. But more importantly, we're talking about products and services that are high priority spends for them. To give you an example, if you look at most households, there is a very strong bias for making sure children's education is prioritized. It's not a discretionary spend. It is something that is not even a hygiene spend. Hygiene is basic education that a child would get. I would put it in the category of aspirational spend within what these households can afford, right? But there is, you sense an underlying pulse of aspiration in this customer sentiment. And that's the most important emotion, I would say, is important to understand and tap into. And I'll give you a practical translation of in the context of education. Several years ago, of course, there were lots of reports that talked about massive vocational training related opportunities in India. But when we spent time on the ground, we realized, A, so much effort was going into in courts, mobilizing students into classrooms to get trained on certain topics, more effort went into placing them, and even more effort had to go into retaining them in those roles, right? So something was clearly broken. It wasn't natural. And we're big believers in not trying to change what consumers want and not trying to educate them and evolve them out of what they are naturally ready to spend on, simply because there is an existing demonstrated demand for a set of things. And that is the immediate opportunity that needs to be solved for, right? And therefore, if you look at the whole space of education, et cetera, you need to study the customer more carefully to see what are the aspirations there and is what is on offer really meeting those aspirations. And only then figure out if you can think about getting ambitious about a business model or an investment theme, right? And so it's small nuances, which is why for me, it's the headlines may all sound similar. When you double click and go deeper into the pulse of that customer and the drivers of their decisions on these spends, there is nuance that could fundamentally change your view on what kind of investment models you look at or how you look to build out these businesses. Similarly, there is the big macro trend, or rather the talk about digitizing and all the customers getting onto digital platforms. As you spend more time on the ground, you realize it is a mixed bag, in the sense that there is no doubt that the internet penetration and the mobile penetration and ability to access digital information on mobile phones is a huge trend and definitely has and will work wonders. But the kind of user personas you think of in the context of mainstream users is very different from these consumers. And therefore, those interfaces need to be custom designed for the segment. So again, I go back to the DNA. Are you designing for that customer persona? And are you tapping into the reality of their worlds? What I've often observed, and by the way, I mean, out here at LMR, we end up spending a lot of time talking to these end customers. We're on field visits, not only in the context of pipeline evaluation or portfolio companies, but very often we're also out with nonprofits, for example. We could be going out with anyone, but just driving across India and talking, having conversations that give us a pulse for things. It's not market research in the conventional sense. But you'll realize that very often the digital burst of information has led to a lot of noise as well and confusion, right? And therefore, what is the medium to long-term plan on building out these distributions, keeping in mind this market is super critical in how we think about investing. Aspiration is a very clear trend.
Yeah.
Even within this customer segment, you sub-segment to see the people who are more ready for this transition into understanding how to navigate the digital world, and you see how that cascading effect plays out. But there's no doubt about the fact that people are ready to look beyond what has been conventional. And even in terms of youth, it's fascinating to see how they're willing to explore career options and take calls that are not based on how the first, you know, the 10, 12 years of school life and their parents may have set out for them. Because I was actually worried a few years ago, and maybe there's a little bit of that worry that continues, that the aspiration with which children are being raised in households for the kind of jobs they would get at the end of school and college is so far from the reality of what they're dealt with once they pass out, right? So I think the good part about some of these digital trends is those divides are getting bridged, and in small ways and bigs, there are opportunities that are coming up that appeals to the natural DNA of this customer segment. And that natural DNA is an entrepreneurial DNA. This whole segment is full of entrepreneurs in their blood, right? So that's the beauty of what it is. And that's the most exciting part about it.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned a very important point, you know, the aspiration that you see, and it could be any segment that caters to that emotion and is able to tap that emotion by building a nuanced product, which takes into consideration what's going to make it a pull product versus a push product, especially for that market. And it could be any sector, like for instance, education seems to be a very clear, you know, opportunity. And we're seeing startups being built in that segment. What would be the top, you know, two or three segments if you had to bet, and that probably speak to, you know, the companies that you have in your portfolio as well, that you think are going to tap this market and be able to grow within this market?
So maybe I can think about it in terms of white spaces that are available, right? As we talk to people on the ground, as we talk to different profiles of people on the ground, there's definitely there are spaces where there aren't enough brands that have been built to cater for this customer segment. And the reason I talk about brands is at some level, there is a complex history of trust building in commerce and business equations that exists when people have been reliant on informal channels for various things, right? Whether it's the good old moneylender of the past or present, or whether it is all that we hear about in agri, whether you know, there are so many instances where the informal markets, actually today, I have huge respect for that because they're the ones that help these consumers survive, because they're ultimately there for good and the formal markets aren't developed enough for them. But at the same time, there is a complex history, and therefore building trusted brands on the ground is super critical. And the spaces where we're probably most excited about, there's definitely a massive rural opportunity. There are definitely huge plays in our own portfolio where we've seen them evolve. Samanuti is an obvious one, given it's play in agriculture. We have a younger rural distribution play called Cybergram that has also entered into spaces which I would say go beyond where most places don't have even basic financial services today, leave alone the onset of all other commercial opportunities, whether it is equipment or agri or you know, even consumer durables for that matter. So there are interesting plays when it comes to rural, and you see the absence of brands in these spaces. And building a trusted brand is going to take a lot of commitment and authenticity and commitment to this end customer segment. Very often we do see platform plays that are trying to cater to multiple stakeholders. We've often seen, for example, you could have a product or a service in the context of agri. Now, is the DNA of the company trying to cater to smallholder farmers, or is it trying to cater to corporates that are trying to reach smallholder farmers? Is the crux of the question we ask ourselves, right? And therefore, again, while rural is a massive play, the success of building a brand for that market is going to depend on how authentic the DNA of the organization is and how sincerely they build out that brand on the ground, because there's no doubt that there's a massive wallet available for those spends, right? Similarly, I would say, I mean, education is something you've touched upon. I would almost say education for us is not a thesis in itself, in the sense it's a continuum that goes from education into employability, right? Because you're talking about a segment where just getting a degree, getting a certificate, getting a skill in itself is not complete. It's far from. If anything, unless they see it linking into revenue generation capabilities, it's like an incomplete statement and an incomplete proposition. So that entire continuum is strong on our radar. And bizarrely, that could get fulfilled even through an MSME services company. Like, we've got a company in Latin America that is effectively helping small business owners digitize and access markets, etc. To me, upskilling the business owner into digital mediums and giving them access not only to, let's say, online marketing, but also to logistics, payments, etc., is all in the education, employability, revenue generation continuum, right? So it's a massive space that can be solved in so many different ways, whether you look at it as agri market linkages, you look at it as anything, but these two themes kind of interplay and feed off each other. Interestingly enough, financial services, and lots of people ask this question, but I'm a big believer that financial services is not a sector or a concept in itself. Especially if you take a market like India, you look at every single vertical and every single supply chain, it is something that facilitates economic transactions in our country, right? And so I see financial services as a necessarily part and parcel of whatever companies do to do business with this customer segment. You can say education, you may still need financing. You can say agriculture, you'll need financing. You can say healthcare, you need financing. You say what you want to, there is a financial services element that's almost a requirement. Yeah. And on the flip side, I would argue that if you have only financial services, it's a tough and a weak thesis, in the sense that there are low-cost balance sheets that can probably make that available. The question is, how well does the financial services play understand the underlying economic transactions, right? And so the DNA and expertise has to go back to the underlying activity as against financial services itself.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very novel thesis, and I'd call it ambitious as well from a VC perspective. And it'll probably take a lot from a founder to come and align and think about, you know, these opportunities on a continuum, like you mentioned, right? So, you know, to that point, do you want to like call out any specific portfolio companies that you think have actually played to this, you know, larger vision and are trying to complete the continuum in the sectors that they're operating in?
To be honest, while our thesis is a continuum, we don't expect companies necessarily to go all the way through the continuum, right? Because it is, to your point, it's ambitious. And honestly, if we were a country of the size of one of our states, maybe we could have tried it that way. But just given the size of this country's opportunity, yeah, you have to be focused in execution, right? And therefore, what I would say is we focus a lot more on solutions. If you look at companies like, let's say, Lead School, they did start off with more focused offerings for a few grades. They went into school. The reason why we looked at a lot of education plays, content plays, distribution plays, etc., but were not convinced, was because most of them approached schools with a product mindset. Whereas Lead School and the founders there, Sumit and Smita, had spent close to 5 years operating their own schools and had a good pulse of what it would take to solve for an affordable private school and not just pitch a product to them which partly caters to their requirements, right? And then try and see. And then, of course, B2B sales in schools a few years ago was untouchable at some level. It wasn't very popular because it hadn't done well. But solving for these schools meant that you weren't banking on a sale of a product, but you had teachers who were so excited by the fact that they could deliver their sessions better, leveraging Lead School's proposition, that teacher training was a byproduct. So they were getting better. And so you didn't have to worry about adoption in quotes of technology and things like that as much, because everyone was aligned and excited about how the solution was playing out. So we do try and identify founders who have the vision to solve for this end customer. And given this end customer is not just looking for a single product, it's not a satiated market where you plug in a small gap, right? It is a wide open market. And therefore, at some level, you want founders who can think beyond product and can solve for that end customer. Similarly, in agriculture, if you take Samunati, even though they started with a working capital proposition, right from the beginning, the conversation was always about how do you solve for that farmer? How do you figure out market linkages? How do you think about inputs? And in a lot of these cases, we're quite happy for founders to figure out partnerships, internal execution, whatever it is. But we do look for founders who have a broader vision for how to solve for that segment and not just a single product roadmap or you know, even multiple products, etc., but something that's a little broader.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it requires that kind of a vision and approach because the market is huge. That also, you know, brings me to the point that you mentioned earlier, and you've participated as a founding investor, and that's a term that which I think you guys should be credited for coining it. A lot of your portfolio companies, you've been the first investor, and it's right that, you know, it's a PE and a VC, you know, crossplay for you. But at the same time, it becomes difficult to come in that early and have a concentrated portfolio. So when you're a founding investor, right, what are the pillars that you're building conviction on, especially when you're backing a startup that early in its life cycle?
So it's interesting that every time I have this conversation with someone on the outside, it feels like we're doing something super bold and gutsy and all of that. But when at that point, when we are about, you know, closing out on an agreement to fund a founder right at the very beginning, it doesn't feel high risk, right? And I'm trying to think, maybe bridging that sense of dissonance may answer parts of your question, because at that point, it feels right. And it feels fairly clear, visible, concrete. And I'll tell you why, because A, we're coming into the conversation after having spent enough time and thought on what this consumer is about, right? And what this customer is willing to spend on and what their life context is, et cetera, et cetera. And secondly, we're kind of looking for an entrepreneur who equally understands that customer segment and knows that market. In fact, I wouldn't say equally, we're looking for someone who knows that market even better than us, because they'll be executing on the ground. And the minute we resonate on our engagement on this vision or ambition for this, building a business in the context or building a brand in the context of this customer segment, it starts feeling right. A big part of our underwriting, obviously, is the founders that we're backing. Because not only should they understand the market, there are lots of people who do, but at some level, I would say we play down the risks by looking for entrepreneurs who have a demonstrated track record as far as building out organizations and some kind of scale is concerned. Very often they may have built it out in the context of some other brand or some other organization, but so long as there's some prior history, it helps. And I would say, finally, we are taking an important call on the timing of the investment. And when I say timing, it's interesting. It's very different from timing in stock markets, because that moves as a function of weeks and months and days. I'm talking about if you take a 15-year block of time, right? If we go in very early on an investment, assuming we have to exit in 5 to 7 years, whoever's buying us out needs to be excited for the next 5 to 7 years. Only then we get a good exit. And ultimately, as an investor, you do ensure that you're planning out an investment from the standpoint of an exit. And therefore, automatically, you're trying to see whether that 15-year time frame is the best time frame in which a certain thesis will play out. And we ideally would like to stay invested to a point where we are benefiting from the inflection point and the momentum and the peak of that journey. And if you were to say that, you know, all of that momentum building happened 2 years after we exit, then obviously it's not successful enough for us, right? Therefore, we have to get that timing right. I mean, Agri is a good example. We could have looked at a lot of plays 10 years ago, because I know we were doing field visits in this context way back, but some elements of the ecosystem didn't feel complete enough. Yeah. And so you have to take a call, and the business needs to get funded, the ecosystem needs to be in place. And so there are some factors that we take a call on. But fundamentally, it's our conviction on what the consumer will spend on, the nuance of their wallet, It is about the entrepreneur and whether we resonate with them on these conversations and align with them, and the confidence we have on their ability to execute and attract talent, etc.
I think you've answered that very well. I thought that was a tough question, and you know, somehow props up this term that is being used more now, which is called operator VC, more in the, you know, tech context, where people are preferring VCs who have, you know, deep market understanding and deep knowledge of the products and the customers that they're building in. But haven't really thought about that from a, you know, social impact or the rural market standpoint. So I can relate to Elevar in those ways, of having a deep conviction and a deep thesis, just by virtue of being close to the customer and having that ingrained in your DNA, as you mentioned.
And if I can add something there, if you ask our founders, I suspect what they, I mean, I guess there is, they do like the conversations with us, but I will say it's not so much because we can necessarily, because we can add as much value. I mean, we're not operationally involved, but I almost feel there's a sense of relief where they don't have to explain the context of their business and their markets, you know, because it's always tough to start a conversation where you have to first spend 80% of your time explaining the context and then get to the point on the discussion, right? And it's a lot easier when that context itself is someone who knows and understands and can relate to the context in which they're building a tough business. Yeah. So.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. So one question before we, you know, talk about your experience and how that's impacted you, you know, as a VC. What's the North Star metric that you ultimately measure, you know, at Elevar for you as a fund? What's the critical metric that you want to like keep growing and keep improving upon?
I actually think the amount of capital our companies raise is a good metric beyond what we invest in, because at some level, we are very clear about our conviction. And I do feel we're a little bit of a bridge between a massive, massive market opportunity on the ground and massive pools of capital that don't necessarily completely understand the upside on this opportunity. I would say that the more capital that flows, we do track how much money flows into our portfolio, whether it's debt, equity, etc. But the more capital that flows, the more growth you have in this portfolio. Bizarrely, it's not so much because our companies actually were a little old school in the sense we believe in profitability of companies over time. And so it's not so much to fund losses, but it is to fuel growth, because you're talking about companies that even in 10 years will get nowhere close to anything more than single digit market shares with all the capital that can flow. Right. And so when you talk about such massive markets, you need to kind of invest capital to make sure that you're growing at a pace that does justice to the opportunity. And I do feel that that's the most important piece, that and the more successful our investments are in terms of generating returns, which is something that plays out in our fund performance, the more capital that flows into this market overall. And that's the exciting part.
Awesome. You know, Joseph, with that, I want to switch gears and talk about, you know, your experience of being an impact investor. Tell me what's, you know, the best part about your job? Like, what do you enjoy most being an impact VC today?
I think in the role I play, I will say that I just feel there are people who are entrepreneurs and there are people who are not. It's not so much of whether they launched a startup or not, but there is an entrepreneurial energy in individuals. And tapping into that energy is the high point of every single day of mine. And that could come in the form of meeting someone on the ground on the field. It could come in the form of field staff that is excited, or a portfolio member who's excited. It could come in the form of entrepreneurs we meet. It's just that entrepreneurial energy. It actually flows from within the organization also. It's people who don't believe as much in compensation, they believe a lot more in backing themselves to generate value and wealth, right? And that you see it across the board. I don't think I would have had access to as much of this energy in many other roles, right? So
that's awesome. Yeah, I think I can agree to that in some ways, because that's something which drives me as well, talking to folks like yourselves, both entrepreneurs and VCs that want to back, you know, entrepreneurs that are creating value for the long term. On the flip side, what's the most challenging part for you, you know, in your role today?
I will say challenging part is sometimes it is about staying disciplined on building this alignment, right? In the sense that because we are focused, there are a lot of opportunities we could pursue, but we know we will not, we'll probably not do as much justice in terms of doubling down on companies, either with capital or our time, if we spread out too thin. Making sure that we are being selective and making sure we are looking for a mutual selection with entrepreneurs, where the entrepreneur feels we're the best for them and we believe they're the best for us, and making sure we get to those right fits at the starting point is the most important decision at some level. And beyond that, I think the passion and the energy for the opportunity typically means that you're fairly engaged. They're always tough journeys, but it's a lot better when you have an aligned partner in entrepreneurs, right? And vice versa. So getting that mix right and making sure you're not distracted by, there are lots of hypes that come and go in the market. You have a fintech, ad tech, ed tech. There's a lot of buzz. Everybody's announcing deals, all of those things. But just making sure you have a sense of quiet confidence in the partnerships you're picking and making sure that you're being thoughtful and meaningful in constructing those partnerships, I will say is the most important element.
No, I agree. Absolutely. Especially with, you know, the kind of buzz that you've seen in the last, you know, year and a half, and the kind of buzz that we're going to see in the coming decade. It's definitely going to be tough for VCs to, you know, keep a high bar for action and a high bar for investment. Okay. One last question before we move into the rapid fire. How has being a VC, you know, influenced your personality over the last decade?
It's one of those things where you probably gain more humility and more confidence in embracing mistakes and backing yourself. So I say humility and confidence because you always think a confident person is the person who's more right than wrong, but that's not the case. A confident person is someone who's comfortable making mistakes. And that's where confidence kind of comes through, right? And I will say the humility in accepting that you could back yourself and go wrong is important because it brings out that conviction, it tests your conviction and shapes you in a certain manner. So
very well said. And especially with, you know, the long feedback cycles that, you know, investors have to deal with when you're playing, you know, 7-year, 15-year game in that time horizon. All right. So now with that, you know, we move into our final segment, which is the rapid fire. I'll shoot some questions and hope to get your honest, immediate thoughts on the same.
Okay.
First question, one thing that you'd like to change to improve the state of the Indian startup ecosystem?
I want to be really honest. I would say there's something right about this ecosystem right now because there's a lot of money flowing and I see people plunging into entrepreneurial journeys, giving up good, plushy jobs. So I think there's something right. I wouldn't change a lot necessarily. There's a wish list that I'm sure is floating around, but I think we're in a phase where something is right about this ecosystem.
Yeah, that's sure. And that's a unique answer. The first answer that I've heard, which says, you know, nothing needs to be changed at this point. Next question. If you had to give a TED talk, what topic would you choose and why?
I would actually talk about this completely untapped opportunity in the consumer segment that hasn't been approached by formal corporate India and emerging markets overall. I think the why is pretty obvious. I actually think the potential on almost every customer segment persona we touch goes into trillions of dollars. And I think I would struggle to imagine why more people don't uncover this. So it's the passion of my life. So
undoubtedly. And yeah, I have read some of your blogs and, you know, it clearly comes out through those writings. But yeah, hopefully we can all hear that tech talk as well at some point. Okay, final question. VCs and founders that you admire and look up to.
That's a very tough one. I'm not going to fall for the naming piece, but I will say to the point I made earlier, I have a huge bias and a soft core for people who are more entrepreneurs, whether they're VCs or founders. Even within VCs, there are people who have taken an entrepreneurial call to go start a fund. And I have a lot of admiration and I look up to those individuals as against people probably, it is a highly paid segment overall. I will say the trade-offs and challenges and the spirit with which you approach things may be different. And I have a bias for people who've taken entrepreneurial calls even as investors.
One last thought that you want to leave all current and aspiring founders that are listening to you through the podcast.
Since we're talking about the space we invest in, I will say that the external data points, market trends, etc., always operate with, they're not synchronous to the realities on the ground, right? They operate with a lead or a lag effect. And beyond a point, I wouldn't ascribe too much weightage to what the market is saying about a certain sector or space. I even I would even say for investors who are investing in companies, very often MIS is a very distant indicator of the realities of the potential of a business, right? So you can look at numbers and try and form an assessment, but the realities on the ground, especially when you're starting up in early stage companies, need to come from a sense of core conviction. And beyond a point shouldn't get swayed one way or the other based on these external macro trends, etc. If that conviction remains strong, which should come from something far more robust than what's written about things, etc., then it's more a matter of time than a binary risk on where things play out, right?
Yeah, I think that's a very good lens for, you know, both VCs and entrepreneurs to look through before jumping on onto what they really want to build and build value for the long term. Amazing. All right, Jyotsna, it's been an amazing conversation. You know, I've learned a lot. Thank you so much, like I said, for taking out the time. It was a pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks, Vijay. Love chatting as well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the VC Bruno podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please let our guests know about it, share your thoughts on social media, and let them know what were your key takeaways. We would truly appreciate if you could subscribe to our podcast on the podcast platform of your choice and leave us a review on Apple iTunes. This will help others discover the podcast. To get insights and to learn more about startups and venture capital, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We will love to hear from you there. You can find all episodes together on our website, thevcpreneur.com. We will be back again next week with another VCpreneur that is making a dent in the venture universe. Until then, take care and keep shining.